Some churches choose to close down for the summer. No small groups, no congregational activities. We don't do much. It's summer. These churches expect people are traveling. They're less regular in attendance, less enthusiasm, less commitment. The conventional wisdom is there's not much return on church investment in the summer, so slow your roll. And never, ever, never try to start something new in the summer. I don't know where that idea came from, but I have a sneaking suspicion nowhere good. I prefer the attitude of our Willowbrook Kids people, the volunteers who work with our young children. They came to me and they said, we know some churches cancel Bible school in the summer. We would like to keep going. Is that okay? I said, yes, you're on. I dropped in on a recent planning meeting for Willowbrook Kids. They were planning the rest of the year for all the kids. They were brainstorming stuff for the kids, for the parents, for families who don't have kids. They're brainstorming stuff for people here who don't have families, for people who aren't here. They were coming up with all kinds of ideas that would bless everybody. Game nights, going to Seabreeze, movie nights, pool parties, going to Darien Lake, axe throwing. I said, I sat there amazed, impressed, delighted. It was fun to watch them dream about how we could serve kids better. Until they got to potlucks. They said, yeah, let's do some potlucks. That's when I had to remind them that it's summer and we should probably back off from starting anything new in the summer. No, I didn't. Though I thought about it, but I didn't do it. No, I like their attitude. And I like the attitude of the guys who lead our congregation. The guys who lead are kind of Custer-esque. Do you remember when George Custer was totally surrounded? And he decided that gave him the advantage because now he could attack in any direction? Our leaders look at summer and they say, why not? Make hay while the sun shines. Give it a shot. Go ahead. That's why this summer Willowbrook is covering 52 big scriptures in 13 weeks. We're using Mark Moore's book, Core 52 Student Edition. Each reading in the book is individually wrapped, so you can jump in at any point and totally be good with what's happening. We have a few books left. We'd love for you to start reading along with us if you're not already reading. But each week this summer, we're reading and thinking about four important things that God wants us to know. Each sermon this summer comes from one of the next four passages that we're going to read. Plus, bonus, we're not even halfway through the book yet, and we're already into the New Testament, which is great. Have you ever read through the Bible in a year? They have those Bible through a year things. You have to read until late October before you get to the New Testament. But we're already up to Jesus, and this week we get to ponder four big ideas about doing life from Jesus' point of view. Two of the readings come from the Sermon on the Mount, things that he said while he was preaching that, one of which was where Jesus said this, don't store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy, where thieves break in and steal. Store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The 3.5 pages that we're going to read tomorrow will explain how Jesus wants us to think about our money. Do you remember that mean old tightwad? That nasty guy who was dying, near death? Nasty man. He was loaded, but he was so stingy. Everybody knew. He is so stingy. He was just a mean old cuss. And his wife urged him. He said, you're dying. Before you die, do at least one good thing in your life. Use your money to help people. And he said, no, it's mine. It's my money. It's all mine. I made it. I have it. And I'm taking it with me. And she said, you can't take it with you. That's crazy. He said, no, I have a plan. And he put several large duffel bags full of money in the attic. He said, when I die, I am going to grab those bags as I fly by, and I'm going to take them with me. On the day that the man died, the wife ran up into the attic to see if anything had happened. And when she saw the bags all still sitting there, she said, I knew he should have put them in the basement. But Jesus actually does say, we can send it on ahead. Jesus talks about money as a resource that can be invested in eternal things. Jesus said, how you spend your money that God entrusts you with reveals a lot about you. Like how you spend money. $3.60 a gallon for gas, $10 for a Moe's burrito, $15 a month for Netflix, $21,000 for a used car, $200,000 for a starter house. Money. But the one that really burns me is $1.24 for Diet Dr. Thunder. $1.24. It used to be 64 cents, like last year. How in the world am I supposed to afford $1.24 for 2 liters of Diet Dr. Thunder as much as I drink? With everything costing more, how do we do all the stuff that we're doing and still invest generously in God's work? First world problems have a way of revealing where your heart is, do they not? Do you love God? Do you love other people? Is the kingdom really your first priority? Whatever you profess about what you value most in life, Jesus says your checkbook will tell the truth. Where you spend your money, what you buy with your money, what you invest your money in, that's like an x-ray into your soul. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Something else Jesus said that we're going to read about this week that's equally crazy. Jesus said to his disciples, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it. So one of the things that the Bible teaches about our stuff is that it's not actually ours, it's God's. There's the Old Testament song that starts out with these lyrics, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. There's another Old Testament song where God sings, every forest animal and the cattle on 1,000 hills, all mine. He owns everything. Everything. Rush Limbaugh's tagline about himself was that he had talent on loan from God. And in that, he was right. Whatever we have, whatever you have, it's from God. Because everything belongs to him because he made it all. We say, my money, my shoes, my food, my car, my house. But God has loaned all of those things to us. And when we're done here, that house, that car, those shoes, that money, that's going to belong to somebody else. It's not really mine. I just get to use it right now because God's letting me. I say, my mind, my body, my voice, my skills. I'm playing pickleball this week. I was playing with two brand new guys. And when I play pickleball, I always talk a lot. And after we had played about half the game, one of the new guys said, have you ever thought about being a commentator? And I smiled and I said, well, actually, that's what I do. But only because of what God's given me. We say my job, my kids, my life, right? Sinatra says, I did it my way. Billy Joel says, my life. But Jesus says, if you follow me, you're going to stop saying that. You're going to stop thinking like that. If you let Jesus train you, you will find yourself becoming more and more willing to sacrifice yourself for others because he does. And you're being like him. He did that to the point of giving up his life. Being like him means being like that. And it happens. If you say, okay, Jesus, do your thing with me. If you say that and you really let him, it will happen. Do you remember the pirate ship that found that pirate out there floating in the sea? And they pulled him in and he was in rough shape. I mean, he had a wooden leg, and he had a hook for a hand. He had a patch over one eye. And they said, dude, what happened to your leg? And he said, oh, we were in a fight with another ship, and a cannonball blew my leg off, so they gave me this wooden leg. And they said, ooh, what happened to your hand? The guy said, well, I was in a sword fight, and the guy cut my hand off, so they gave me this hook for a hand. They said, what happened to your eye? The guy said, well, a seagull flew overhead one time, and I looked up, and it did its business in my eye. And they said, and that was enough for you to lose your eye? And the guy said, no, but that was the day I just got my hook. Some stuff happens without you even really thinking about it happening, right? Or over time, you hardly notice and things change inside of you if you hang out with certain people. Suffering, sacrifice, that's how Jesus made the world better, and it will be the same in your life. If you ask Jesus into your life, if you open yourself up to him, if you let him teach you how to do life, you will find yourself more and more giving yourself away, giving your life away so that others can be better off. Like the world was made better this week for a lot of inner city Rochester kids. They got fed, they got to swim, they learned about Jesus, they were loved, they were cheered for. It was a great week for a whole bunch of Rochester kids, but Maggie's camp costs. and all the churches in Victor, and 20 local high school students, and 20 adults all had to give up life, money, time, relaxation to make that good happen. It took sacrifice on a bunch of people's part. One morning this week at 9 a.m., I get a call from Adam Grandusky. And Adam says, "John, where are they?" He said, "I'm here, where they're supposed to be, but they're not here." And I said, "Oh, Maggie's camp is always late. They just hang in there, you'll find them." And he did, and they did. We will not have impact on the world like Jesus did unless we're willing to live like Jesus did. And Jesus said, "Yes, if that's what it takes, I will pay that. I will wait here. I will eat that. I will carry that cross. If that's what it takes, I will do that." When asked whether Christians should wear religious jewelry or not, should Christians wear crosses, I like the guy who said, "I think crosses on Christians do far less to change the world than Christians on crosses." We cannot claim to follow Jesus if we're not willing to imitate him, sacrifice like he does. It reminds me of the guy who said, "The problem with a living sacrifice is that it keeps climbing off the altar." Jesus said, we are to be sacrifices. One of the readings this week we will deal with will deal with our willingness to deny ourselves, to carry a cross, to sacrifice ourselves, to lose our lives so that others can find theirs. And another one of the four verses that we're going to deal with this week, that we're going to read about this week, is who gets to go to heaven? What does Jesus say about who gets to heaven? This is kind of a big one in that most people want to. Very few people, when asked, don't want to go to heaven. In fact, at funerals, that is where everybody wants me to say the dead person is. Going to heaven is a pretty big deal with most people. But Jesus says, and he should know, not everybody does. Tells a story about the prince's wedding. Do you remember that one? Jesus' story about the prince who was getting married. But the invitees could not be bothered to attend. They were too busy. So the king locked them out. And he invited a bunch of other people who never thought they would get invited to that. And those people came happily. And then at the end, somebody tried to sneak in the side door without getting permission from the king. And the king booted him. And Jesus wraps up the story saying, for many are invited, but few are chosen. And some people don't like this story. They don't like Jesus' story because there are people in the story who don't end up good. And some people say, everybody should get in the end, or else God is not good, because how could a good God order somebody to be bound and abandoned to weeping and gnashing of teeth? How could a good God pick some people to get in and other people to be destroyed or burned? What kind of God would let something like that happen? If he's God, he should do that better. And if you've ever thought that, here's what it really comes down to. Our understanding of what God is like comes down to this. A lot of how you see the Bible has to do with how you answer this question. Here's the question. Can God make a rock so big that he can't lift it? And you say, oh, a tricky question, Walker. Can God make a rock so big that he can't lift it? Well, God can do anything. He's God. So he can certainly make a rock so heavy that no one could lift it. But wait, if it's so big that he can't lift it, that would be something God can't do. So most people come down in the end, they say, no, there is nothing that God can't do. There is no rock so big that he can't lift it. And that's fine. But thinking like that leads to the place where nothing we do really matters. That's that view of God, of an overpowering, irresistible force who does whatever he wants, no matter what anybody else wants, is a very Greek view of God. Like God should be just all the time himself. But the Bible shows a different God, a real God, who is willing to limit himself, who gives permission to others, who grants real power to others. The God of the Bible allows other people, us, to have a real say in what happens in the end. And God is always true to his word. He does what he says he will do. So if he bequeaths us a bunch of prerogatives saying, go ahead, you get to make the choice. If he says we have the choice, he's going to honor that. That will stand whatever we choose. And if you tell God you don't want him guiding you, you can manage your life fine on your own, bug off, God will honor that up to and including at the end, even though that would end up badly. Because that's the way he is. He thinks so much of you that he lets you make your own choices. And if you choose to honor him and do life with him, he will invite you to his son's wedding reception. But if you defy him, if you ignore him, if you don't have any time for him, if that's your choice, then he will honor that choice because he said he will respect our decisions. Can God make a rock so big he can't lift it? Yes. And it wouldn't have to be a big rock. If there was a pebble somewhere, and God said, I am never going to pick up that pebble, then he couldn't. Because what he says, he will do. What he says he won't do, he won't do. Which is why many are invited, but few get in. Because we get to choose, and then we reap the consequences of our decisions. So, those are the things we're going to read about this week. All good sermon topics, right? Money. Who doesn't want to hear a good sermon topic about, a good sermon about money every now and again? I mean, if we were going to announce out on the board, we're only talking about money this week, people would just be streaming in, right? How about suffering? People would cancel weekend travel plans to be here if we said, oh, we're going to do a sermon on suffering this week. How about Arminianism versus Calvinism? Free will versus unconditional election? Christians have been fighting for that for 500 years. I'm sure that would just draw a lot of people in today. I could preach about any of those today, but I decided to do the really hard one. Those three are challenging to present in a meaningful way, but I thought we might as well just do the hardest of the four. Are you ready? Here's the hardest of the four we're going to read this week. Jesus says, so in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. For this sums up the law and the prophets. And I know, that seems like that's probably the easiest of all the four. It's the golden rule. Everybody knows that. It's what parents tell their kids all the time. Do unto others you have to do. Everybody knows that one. It's on posters, for goodness sake. Do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. How is that choosing to talk about the hardest thing? And I got to admit, before Sunday night, I was not going to choose that one. But then two things happened. Two things happened this week. The first was I saw a movie. Were you out Sunday night? Sunday night was crazy flooding in Canandaigua, right? We thought, as we drove to Canandaigua, that a water main had broken. But then, when miles and miles of 332 had water flowing across it, we said, wow, that's not a water main, that's something way bigger. And when we got to the Canandaigua Theater, it was hard to find a place to park because the whole parking lot was a lake. It was wild rain in Canandaigua. We got through that, we went inside, we watched a movie called Sound of Freedom. And I knew what the movie was about going in. I knew what it was going to be about. So when the little girl is sitting there in the opening scene, innocently singing a sweet song, I had already forgotten about the rain and my heart had already started to break. And for 2 hours, we sat there watching this government guy try to locate and rescue two trafficked kids. And the thing is, in the movie, it was presented as hopeless. There was no way he would find these kids, and yet he kept going. He lost his mind. He lost his job. More than once, he nearly lost his life, but he would not stop. You know why? They weren't even his kids. You know why he kept going? Because he just kept thinking, what if those were my two kids? What if I was the father, and someone had stolen my children? The guy said, what if there was somebody out there, and our roles were reversed? What would I want that man to do for my kids? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Folks, human trafficking is a vile evil that is happening in our world right now, more than has ever happened in the world. And probably the only reason we're not doing everything we can to stop it is because our kids aren't missing. If our kids had been taken, if one of ours was being sold by sick people to other sick people, we would be doing something about it. Aggressively, right? And we would not stop till we got our kids back. If one of the kids in our youth group got taken and sold into slavery, our whole church would be all in. And the point of Sound of Freedom is not to tell a story, which it does powerfully. The point of Sound of Freedom is to expose a need, which it can if you're open to seeing it. Throughout the whole movie, I was thinking, thank you, God, for protecting Carice and Jess. And I was thinking, if I were the father in this movie, what would I want people to do? And the answer I came up with is something. I would want everybody to do something. So understanding that God is the only real hope in terrible situations like this, I have been all week praying for freedom and restoration for kids. I have been praying for conversion and repentance for traffickers and pedophiles and those who are addicted to porn. I have been praying for wisdom and courage for lawmakers and safety and success for rescuers. I have been searching for groups who are doing those things so that we can invest in that. because if someone I loved was being bought and sold, that's what I would want other people to do for me. But do you see how this is one of the most challenging of all Jesus's teachings? To see life from another person's point of view, to figure out what you would want if you were them, and then to act on it, that would cost you money. That would cost you time. That might lose you your sense of normal. That might cost you life. You might have to sacrifice to do for others what you would want them to do for you if you were in their position. That might require you to kind of live like Jesus, giving yourself up for others. That might be hard. So I told you two things happened this week. One was I saw that movie. You ought to see it. You should see Sound of Freedom. By the way, there is nothing overtly sexual in it at all, which is amazing. The makers of the movie said, how could we put something sexually gratuitous in there in any way? We would be doing what we're fighting against. There is nothing overtly sexual in it. You should see that movie. But the other thing that happened this week, I lost my wallet. First time ever. I mean, I have misplaced it plenty of times in the past, but I just retrace my steps and I lift something up and I find it. Not this time. I lost my wallet. Maybe at the theater. So I called the theater. No, nobody had turned in a wallet. So I searched my car, nothing. So I searched my house, nothing. So I searched my car, nothing. So I called the theater, still nothing, but they would have the janitor look tonight when he comes in. So I searched my house twice. So I looked in my car again, nothing. So I drove to Canandaigua, I waited for the movie to end, I went into the theater, I crawled on the sticky floor underneath where I was sitting. I felt down in the seat, which was scary. I drove around the parking lot slowly. I called all the people that I had been with since it got lost. I even came to the church building and looked here, knowing that I had not been to the church building since I lost my wallet. Nothing. I spent every free minute for 2 days looking for my wallet. I looked a lot. I got my wife and my mom and my daughter involved in the hunt. Nothing. And our current best guess is that I was wearing new pants with shiny, slippery pockets, and my wallet fell out while I was running through the parking lot in the rain, and it got washed away. And I tell you all that for two reasons. Number one, if you happen to be at Canandaigua Lake this week and see a wallet float by, it's probably mine. Grab it, please. Number two, I just spent 2 days of my life searching hard for a wallet. And I did that immediately after God had arranged for me to be painfully made aware that there are children out there who are lost, desperately needing to be searched for and found. And I rearranged my life for 2 days to look for a wallet with a couple of credit cards that can be replaced in 4 to 6 business days, and a Costco and a AAA membership card that I never use, and a driver's license with a picture I never liked. A wallet, $4 and some Band-Aids. And I'm searching frantically for a wallet. I am spending time and thought and emotional energy on a wallet because I value it. While there are parents whose children are missing, parents who would give anything, risk everything, pay any price to get their kids back. And when I realized what that said about what I really treasure in life and where my heart is, but then I thought, wow, there's something even worse than being trafficked by evil people. And that is to be taken captive by the evil one and made a slave of hell forever. You made that connection already, right? God's got children who have been stolen and are being abused and have no hope of ever escaping on their own. You know that, right? And every day, all day long, God is working to get them out. And he's hoping that we will help him do that. Every day, all day long, he's trying to get his stolen children back to safe with him. Okay, now you and God, if the roles were reversed, whatever we would want God to do for us, we do for him, right? Jesus said a lot of things that go against the grain, hard, revealing, insightful things. But probably one of the most challenging things that he ever said, if you dare to consider what this really means for how you're going to spend the rest of your life, for what you're going to search for the rest of your life, is so in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. For this sums up the law and the prophets. So let the doing begin. And hey, if potlucks will really help in God's rescue work, bring some food next Sunday. Let's pray.